Chapter 7.
It was time to find a factory job. The butchers urged me to try to get into steel or auto. Of course, I already knew that. I wasn't a damn fool. The strength of the unions in those heavy industries had won livable wages and decent benefits. But Edwin said there was more to it than that. The trade unions safeguarded job security. She told me that unlike a non-union shop, if she had a run-in with a jerk on the plant floor, it didn't signal her last day on the job. You couldn't be fired just because some foreman didn't like your face. With union protection, all the butchers agreed, a he/she could carve out a niche and begin earning valuable seniority. In the meantime, while I was waiting for an opening, I had to work through the temporary labour agencies at minimum wage. In early autumn, the agency sent me to a one-day job on the loading docks of a frozen food plant. My heart leapt when I saw Grant walking into the factory ahead of me. I caught up to her and shook her hand. Unloading trucks on the docks was male turf. It meant a lot to have another butch watch your back. Grant dug her gloved hands deep inside the pockets of her blue navy coat. "Brr," she shivered. "I'm freezing my ass off out here. Let's get inside." Then she sauntered very slowly towards the loading docks. She never hurried. She was so cool. One of the truckers shouted, "He/she's at high noon." Several guys peered out from inside the plant and shook their heads in disgust. It was going to be a long shift. I was glad we walked slowly, like we owned the goddamn parking lot. We climbed up on the dock. The foreman came out to look us over. Grant took off her glove and extended her hand. At first, the foreman looked like he wasn't going to shake her hand, but he did. What little respect Grant got, she earned. The afternoon was waning. The sun dipped low in the winter sky. A brutal wind blew off the frozen lake. The huge semi we were unloading served to block the wind, but not the cold. I shivered. We were told we would unload two of these long, long trucks during the shift. We both nodded. Personally, I had my doubts. We worked in silence with two guys. Neither of the men spoke a word to us. They hardly spoke to each other. When Grant and I had to get around the men, we all dropped our eyes. It was harder to bear than a storm of insults. The cartons of frozen food weren't as heavy as I thought, not for the first 3 or 4 hours. After that, they felt like they were filled with cold steel. My muscles ached and burned. I felt elated as the truckload emptied. I worked faster. Grant slowed me down with a well-intentioned glare. I had forgotten another semi was coming until I saw it parked, waiting in the lot. We had a 10-minute breather as one truck pulled away and the other backed in. Then we began unloading the endless rows of cartons in its trailer. Sweat ran in rivulets between my breasts, but my head was frozen and my ears burned like fire. That's when I noticed with horror that both of the men we were working with were missing pieces of their ears. Frostbite. In some plants, the men were missing a finger down to the second joint, or a thumb. Out here on the docks, which butt up against the frozen lake, the men gave up little exposed pieces of their bodies. It frightened me. I wondered what I would be forced to sacrifice in order to survive. I shuddered. Grant gave me a slight push that made me focus again on the task at hand. She looked me up and down to make sure I was all right. She wouldn't ask out loud. In order to be safe on men's terrain, it was necessary to work with dignity, as though the job was effortless. I also didn't want Grant to see me cold and scared and tired. She seemed fine. She wasn't even breathing hard. When the shift finally ended, we got the night foreman to sign our time cards and hightailed it out to the parking lot. We sat in Grant's car, smoking cigarettes in silence. My arms trembled with exhaustion. It was the first real break we'd had in 8 hours. Our smoky breath formed ice crystals on the windshield. Grant revved up the engine and turned up the radio on low as we waited for the car to warm up. "Wasn't too bad," I said casually. "Huh? Are you kidding?" she asked me incredulously. "Halfway through, I thought I'd die." I registered shock. "For real? You made it look so easy." She laughed. "You must be joking. The only thing that got me through was it looked like it wasn't bothering you much. I figured I had to show you an old butch like me could still keep up with a young punk like you." For a moment, I felt uneasy. If she relied on me, she had no idea what a thin reed she leaned on. Then I flushed with gratitude as I realized how she was holding me up, even at this moment. "You pulled it off, kid." She punched my shoulder lightly. "Jesus," she added, as a look of fear crossed her face. "Did you see the ears on those guys?" We finished our cigarettes in silence, lost in similar thoughts. It was always hard the first day I started working at a new factory. It wasn't easy for anyone. It took a while for a new person to be accepted into the community of a plant. Before co-workers invested their caring in you, they wanted to know if you were staying. Many workers never came back after the first day or couldn't make quota. Others made it almost to the eve of the 90 days required to join the union, only to be laid off. I planned to stay at this bindery, if I could. I easily made quota the first day, feeding machines and packing skids. By day two, I slowed down. If quota was made too effortlessly, the foreman would raise it. I was being watched, and I knew it. The first day I wore sunglasses, defensively, all day long. I didn't take off my denim jacket and kept it buttoned up over my black t-shirt. This was a small sweatshop with a company union, and I was the only he-she in the plant. If this were a big plant, I would be one of the many he-she's, so many we would probably have our own baseball or bowling teams within the factory complex. There, I would probably have bound my breasts at work, worn a white t-shirt with no jacket, and found my place among our own smaller societal structure within the life of the plant. But despite the fact that I hadn't yet been initiated into this society, kindnesses were not withheld. At lunch, I bought a bottle of pop from the machine near the time clock and I sat down on a skid to eat my bologna sandwich. Muriel, one of the older native women who worked near me on the line, offered me half her apple. I stood and thanked her. I ate it appreciatively. Each morning for the next week, Muriel offered me coffee from her thermos. Everyone watched us, weighing everything they could observe. Those moments before the whistle blew in the morning were precious because they were ours. Only the ka-chunk of the time clock stole the last one from us. We all dragged ourselves out of bed a little earlier in the mornings to be at the plant a quarter of an hour before we had to punch in. We drank coffee and ate rolls, talked and laughed. We talked all day long, too. The owners only rented our hands, not our brains. But even talking had to be negotiated when it was on the boss's time. If we seemed to be having too much fun, laughing and enjoying ourselves too much, the foreman would come up behind us and hit the solid wooden work tables with a lead pipe while he growled, "Get to work!" Then we'd all look at our hands as we worked and press our lips together in silent anger. I think the foreman sometimes got nervous after he'd done that, sensing the murderous glances he received moments after he turned his back. But he was assigned to keep us under control. That required keeping us divided. We came from many different nationalities and backgrounds. About half the women on the line were from the Six Nations. Most were Mohawk or Seneca. What we shared in common was that we worked cooperatively, day in and day out. So we remembered to ask each other about each other's back or foot pains, family crises. We shared small bits of our culture, favorite foods, or revealed an embarrassing moment. It was just this potential for solidarity the foreman was always looking to sabotage. It was done in little ways all the time. A whispered lie, a cruel suggestion, a vulgar joke. But it was hard to split us up. The conveyor belt held us together. Within weeks, I was welcomed into the circle, teased, pelted with questions. My differences were taken into account, my sameness sought out. We worked together, we talked, we listened. And then there were songs. When the whistle first blew in the mornings, there was a shared physical letdown among all the women and men who worked between its imperative commands. We lumbered to our feet, stood silently in line to punch in, and took our places on the assembly line. Next to each other, facing each other. We worked the first few moments in heavy silence. Then the weight was lifted by the voice of one of the native women. They were social songs, happy songs that made you feel real good to hear them, even if you had no idea what the words meant. I listened to the songs, trying to hear the boundaries of each word, the patterns and repetitions. Sometimes one of the women would explain to us later what the song meant, or for which occasion or time of year it was sung. There was one song I loved the best. I found myself humming it after I punched out in the afternoons. One day, without thinking, I sang along. The women pretended not to notice, but they smiled at each other with their eyes and sang a little louder to allow me to raise my own voice a bit. After that, I started looking forward to the songs in the morning. Some of the other non-native women learned songs too. It felt good to sing together. One wintry Friday night, before we punched out, Muriel invited me to go to an indoor powwow on Sunday. I said yes, of course. I felt honoured. There were a few other black and white workers at the social, friendships too valuable to explore solely on company time. I began to go regularly and got strung out on fry bread and corn soup. Once or twice I was cajoled to get up and join a round dance. I must say that although the pounding of the drum resounded in my heart, it never got as far down as my feet. I felt awkward dancing and self-conscious about being so butch. Of course, Muriel's daughter Yvonne being there made me self-conscious too. I had a fierce crush on Yvonne. She worked in the front office of the same factory. Everyone knew she was the girlfriend of a local organized crime boss. That didn't stop us from knowing where each other was in the room during those socials. I think all the women noticed right away. I'd already decided I wasn't even going to think about approaching Yvonne, even though she seemed to like me. Some of the older butchers had warned me that sometimes on a job, the guys would pressure one of the women to sleep with a he-she, as a joke, and then come back and tell everyone about it. That was the last day on the job for the butch, who usually left in shame. But sooner or later, the stigma also came back around and stuck on the woman who slept with one of us. And she had to leave too. I was afraid of this at first with Yvonne, but she wasn't like that at all. One night, when a group of us went out after work and got drunk, she told me that her boyfriend had suggested he wanted to watch us make love, and she had told him to fuck off. Once that had been said out loud, however, it was hard not to think about making love with Yvonne. Just before Christmas, the crew from work went to a bar near the plant for a few beers. There was a heavy snowstorm outside. Inside, we drank and laughed. By the time we left, the snow had nearly covered the cars. I heated the car door key to Muriel's old Dodge with my lighter to defrost it. When I finally got the car door open, Yvonne kissed me right on the mouth. She left me in that parking lot, stunned and excited. The next night, I went to the Malibu and wondered the whole time what it would be like to bring Yvonne there. I was happy at the plant, flirting with Yvonne, listening to Muriel's stories, waiting for the next social. On Friday nights, we drank at the bar where we cashed our checks. Saturday nights, I spent at the gay bar. I was feeling just fine. Then one day, when the plant whistle blew, silence hung heavy in the air. I looked from face to face. Something was up. Muriel spoke first. "Today, you start the song," she suggested casually. "Any song you want." I looked around in disbelief, but she was serious. I felt the blood rise in my face. I didn't want to call attention to myself. I didn't want to hear my voice rise alone, even for a minute, above the sounds of the machines and the other women. In fact, I realized I felt ashamed of my own voice. "I can't," I protested. I felt near tears. No one said a word. They just kept working in silence. By lunchtime, I realized there would be no songs until I began one. "Why?" I wondered. "Why are the women doing this to me? Are they making fun of me?" I knew it wasn't true. They noticed how quietly I mouthed the words to songs. They were inviting my voice to join theirs. They were honoring me again. That night, I lay awake in panic. The daily routine wouldn't resume until I sang alone. My throat clenched at the very idea. I thought about calling in sick, but it was too cowardly and it wouldn't change anything. No one was going to forget I was asked to start the first song. Besides, the next day was Christmas Eve. I would lose my holiday pay if I called in sick. And immediately after the holiday, I was eligible to join the union. In the morning, I tried to act normal at work. I was welcomed as usual. When Yvonne came in, I wondered if she had heard. Her smile let me know she had. The whistle blew. Each of us punched in. We took our places in the line. The tension was thick. I cleared my throat several times. Muriel watched her hands while she worked. She smiled gently. This was it. I would try to find my voice and be proud of it. After several false starts, my voice began to rise, singing the song I loved most, the first song I'd learned. Almost immediately, the other women lifted their voices up with mine to spare me any pain. We all smiled at each other and sang with tears in our eyes. After lunch, the foreman called me into his office and handed me a pink slip. "Sorry," he said. He escorted me to my locker to get my things. I wasn't allowed to say goodbye to anyone. I actually felt embarrassed about being fired. I knew it was because I was so close to getting into the union. And I knew management had been watching the growing solidarity with great trepidation. But my shame rekindled as I realized the foreman probably heard my voice rising alone in song. I walked home in the snow. The deep drifts muffled all the sounds of the city. I felt pretty low. Immediately after the holiday, I'd have to begin job hunting all over again. When I got home, I hoped the phone would ring. It didn't. I had nothing to look forward to except watching the Perry Como's Christmas special. That made me feel much worse. Drinking didn't help either. Not that it ever did. I was thinking about going out to the Malibu when I heard footsteps thumping up the stairs. I opened the door. There was Muriel, Yvonne, and some of the other native women from the plant. They bought me food and a few wrapped presents. They were on their way to a social. I was invited. Muriel watched my face with mock solemnity as she said, "Now you learn to dance."